Thank you all for coming back so promptly from our break. Just a point of order, at 11:30, regardless of where we are on the agenda, we are going to recess to closed session. Board will eat their lunch, and we will have a conversation on item, what is that, 13-0, discussion of personnel matters. So in case we interrupt you abruptly, I want to let you know ahead of time that's what our intention is. So 11:30, we'll be taking a break for lunch. So with that, we'll move into item 8, Manhattan Water Board Supplemental Environmental Project Program Update.
Thank you very much. This is a follow-up from when the board originally adopted the set policy. But you asked us to come back to report on how it's going and its progress. So this is that presentation. So I'm going to hand it over to Eric Taxer, who's going to walk you through that.
All right. Well, good morning, Madam Chair, members of the board. My name is Eric Taxer, Water Resource Control Engineer in your Lake Tahoe office. And as a shameless plug, I'm also from the lovely town of Portlandia, known for their recycling and composting programs. That seems to be the theme today. So I'm excited to give you an update of where we stand with the SEP program that you adopted back in February of 2014. You adopted it by adoption of the resolution. And when you adopted the program, you deferred full implementation of the program pending completion and evaluation of a pilot program. The pilot program was also adopted at the February 2014 meeting. The pilot program was basically an agreement that we created with the Truckee River Watershed Council to complete 3 restoration projects located in the Truckee River watershed. The funding from that project, for those projects, was basically $700,000 that remained from the North Star Mountain Properties settlement account. This funding pretty much closed the gap that was remaining in these restoration projects. As we discussed yesterday out in the field, a lot of the restoration projects that the Watershed Council conducts are funded by multiple entities. So we are one of many entities that help close the gap in funding these restoration projects. So I'm going to walk you through these restoration projects, and then after that we'll go into where we stand with the set program. So the first project on the list is the Elizabethtown Meadows Restoration Project. The Watershed Council completed the legal documentation and permitting and project design last year, and it was initially scheduled to be construction was initially scheduled to be implemented last year, but it was delayed because Liberty Energy decided that they wanted to place a power line project through that restoration area. So the Watershed Council thought it would probably be wise to defer, implementation of that restoration until we can determine the impacts of the proposed power line replacement project. Right now, pending agreements with Liberty Energy, the project is tentatively scheduled to be implemented this October, I believe, or September, for one of Truckee River watershed days.
Don't they have to restore whatever they disturb?
Well, they do. But, if they're going to, it seems silly to restore an area.
I agree. Though. Yeah. Just want to make sure that they have responsibility.
Absolutely. And additionally, the land trust, which owns the property, they have an access road through the property that they wanted to retain use of until this summer. So that was another reason for delaying the implementation of the project. So here's a picture of one of the areas that will be restored. It's a meadow area, and there's a channel that has been incised through that, to the middle of the meadow. That is from an old utility line that was buried. And it was either backfilled with material that was more erosive than the surrounding meadow habitat, or it was backfilled to a contour that was lower than the surrounding area. Regardless, flood flows that go through this meadow have now been channelized and created incision through this channel. And that is beginning to dry out the meadow. So the goal, one of the goals of this project is to bring that back up to grade and to restore the flood flows to the meadow area.
I have to interject that that is Starker in the picture. That's very important to know. He's named after Starker Leopold.
Starker makes many appearances in these photos. Here is the access road that is also going to be restored. It goes along the drainage. This road will be revegetated. Culverts will be removed, and drainage of, the drainage access up and down gradient of that road will be restored. So the expected gains from this project are to restore 120 feet of incised meadow drainage, to restore the hydrologic connectivity to an acre of meadow, to recontour and revegetate that 300-foot road section and reconnecting the drainages above and below that road. The next project on the list is the Dry Creek Restoration Project. Construction on this project was initially scheduled to begin last fall as well. However, that project was delayed because the Forest Service had not completed its project layout and design at that time. But that's been completed, and the Watershed Council has been busy completing their CEQA documentation and permitting for that project, and it's now scheduled to commence construction next month. So, and this is an area that has experienced erosion, channel incision, and whatnot from legacy logging impacts in the past. Here's one of the many sites that is proposed to be restored. It's an incised channel section that has incised to such a level that it is drying out the floodplain area surrounding the channel incision. And it's drying it out, so we are now getting sagebrush encroachment into the floodplain. So one of the goals will be to bring this back up, to plug that in, kind of like what we saw at Peralta Meadows, the plugging process, and to restore flood flows back to that meadow area, and then return it back to a wetland meadow habitat. So the goals of this project will be to restore over 14 acres of meadow, and to restore almost a mile of stream channel, and to fill in more than a half mile of eroded gullies. The next project on the list is the Middle Martis Creek Wetlands Restoration Project. And again, construction was scheduled to begin last fall, but during the CEQA review process, there were some archaeological issues that were uncovered, so to speak, and that delayed project implementation. But those have been resolved now, and construction is scheduled to begin this August. One of the interesting things on this is that Beth pointed out during the discussion yesterday is that we do have additional funding for this project from the Department of Fish and Wildlife's Cap and Trade Program to include this project in the Sierra-wide study of to evaluate greenhouse gas benefits, carbon sequestration from restoration projects such as this one. So this is an area where Middle Martis Creek in the past created a braided channel system over the real fan, but from the construction of Highway 267, that braided system was channelized into a single culvert. If we got a chance to go out there yesterday in the lightning and whatnot, we would have seen head cuts such as this. This is created from huge flows going through that culvert, and it's hoped to the project will prevent head cutting and erosion by reducing the peak flows from that channel. And this is a picture of the alluvial fan in the Martis Valley. It's because it has been channelized with a single channel and the braided channels have been removed, it's beginning to convert to an upland habitat. So as Beth pointed out yesterday, one of the goals would be to bring some of the high flows into this, back to this area, and restore this area back to meadow and wetland habitat. So the goals of this project will be to restore and enhance 37 acres of wetland habitat, to restore a mile of historic intermittent stream channel, to reduce 1.5 miles of existing stream and channel erosion, improve 2 acres of riparian vegetation, and also reduce the flood risk that we currently see along Highway 267. So that's our pilot program. Throughout the process of this last year and a half of working with the Watershed Council and implementing the pilot program, we've been keeping a list of, gosh, wouldn't it be nice if the SET program were tweaked to do this, that, or the other thing? You know, how do these projects relate to the SET program that was adopted by the board? And we came up with only three items, actually, that we needed to address. First is to, we realized that it's important to include a mechanism for our partner organizations to provide us with a regular update to the SET list. In the SET program that was adopted, that requirement is there, that they would provide us with a list every year or 2 years. But somehow that language didn't quite make it to the MOU template. So that's something that we will make sure that before we enter into any agreements with partner organizations, that there'll be a drop-dead date of when projects will be submitted to us for inclusion on the list, and also be appropriate to have partner organizations let us know when projects should be withdrawn, either because they've been completed or conditions have changed or they've been funded from other sources, so that we don't have a list of projects that really shouldn't be considered. The other item is to develop a project submittal form. Many of the different partner organizations, when they request funding from 319 grants or whatnot, they have various forms that they use, and it was determined that it would really be helpful and make our lives easier if we had developed a form specific to us that we could easily glean the information necessary to ensure that it complies with the requirements that the board established in the program. And finally, there's the issue of overhead. We debated about whether it's appropriate to come up with a certain allowable overhead or a range of overhead for partner organizations to charge for projects. And that turned into a nightmare. As we saw yesterday, the amount of overhead for different projects can vary considerably. For example, across the Meadows, that's probably a project that where there are subcontractors involved. So the amount of oversight to manage contracts is probably a lot less than, say, the Cold Creek area, where the Watershed Council is actively managing volunteer crews to go out there and do planting and whatnot. So there's a lot of variation. And Watershed Council said, well, why don't you just look at personnel service expenses and operating expenses, which seems to make sense. When an organization submits their projects, it's going to be a pretty well-vetted project. It's already completed CEQA review. It's pretty well on the way to being permitted. And the project, the criteria for the project, or all the boundaries of the project and the budget, will pretty much already been laid out. So it shouldn't be a great burden to figure out, well, how much you're going to be charging for managing this project. And that can be something that we can evaluate to ensure it's appropriate. So on both this information, we conducted outreach to all the different organizations in our region that we are aware of that conducts restoration projects. These included all the integrated regional water management groups and other organizations that, nonprofit organizations that we knew of. We did receive responses from the Truckee River Watershed Council, obviously, to participate in our program, and we've been working with them to develop appropriate materials for us to evaluate and to start working on an MOU. We're going to be meeting with the Inyo Mono IRM group next week, actually, to have similar discussions. And in the end of August, we're meeting with the Mojave Water Agency and that Transition Habitat Conservancy down in the Victorville area.
Yes.
I note that the Tal Sierra IRWM is not on the list. Are you going to reach out to them?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, yes, we did actually. We sent them an interest, but we haven't received a response back. I'm probably because Lynn Nolan was on vacation for a while. So, but yeah, and I do go to their meetings, so they're aware of this too. So, and on these outreach programs, I'm pretty much riding on the coattails of Cindy Weiss and Jan Zimmerman, because they already have established relationships with these organizations. So they're making it easy for me to reach out to them. So kudos to those guys. And I just wanted to throw this up here because it's a handy-dandy little flowchart that Cindy and I developed. And I use this in my outreach to all the IREN groups. But it just provides a nice visual representation of the relationships between all the different entities involved in our program. It shows, one of the takeaways, it shows a contractual relationship between a partner organization, in this case an IREN organization, and the discharger, and that it's a partner organization who is funding or overseeing full SEP implementation. And it's the DART is the discharger who is basically still responsible to ensure that the SEP is either completed or they're still on the hook to pay any deferred penalty amount pending successful completion of the SEP. And that's our update. Do you have any questions for me?
It's a good presentation. Any questions or comments from the board? Mr. Humphrey?
I have a question. Prefaced with the comment that we certainly picked the right pilot, and we're certainly very fortunate to come into this with a pilot with such a wonderful partner and to experience the degree of success that we did. It's that's really gratifying. My question is whether or not you feel that the existing resolution is adequate to allow you then to go forward with these other people that you're doing outreach with to establish the relationship with them in advance of any possible SEP coming up, or is there some way that you think that the board needs to relook at that in light of the experience?
Right. No, I do think it's adequate. The it provides flexibility for our executive officer to make any small changes. And the only changes that we need to address are in the attachment, which is a template MOU. And those are going to be something that either our executive officer or the board will evaluate prior to actually signing off on the dotted line with any organization. So, but in general, the resolution is, I believe, as good as it is.
And the reason I ask that is, for a reason, is I think Dr. Horn, earlier in our last agenda item, made a really good point about what our expectations are of who's going to bring us projects and or potential projects, and what process are those potential projects a result of. And I don't know that you can do one size fits all. This is the way you have to organize your local entity, but I want to make sure of two things, really. One is, do you think that there's any way in which we need to clarify to people, or maybe you do this during your meeting like next week, about what those expectations are? And two, I would hope that perhaps we could prevail upon the Truckee River Council people to share their secrets of wonderfulness with some of the other organizations which are not as established or may not have the same capacity in terms of resources, to kind of move them to a position where they can be more completely responsive to our expectations.
Many grants that agencies can secure come with a certain percentage allocation of that grant that can be used for administrative overhead or things like that. Does staff have an idea of what you would like to see in this?
Yes. We do look at the 319 grant process as a model. And I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, I believe the allowable overhead range is around 12 to 16 or 18%, depending. But again, that would be a nice goal as far as, you know, if you're going to be subcontracting out the work, then if it's above that level, why? Yeah.
Right.
And that's something important to consider, especially if we're not going to establish a set range, that we're just going to do actual project expenses and operating expenses.
Mm-hmm. So are you looking for a percentage from the board or just...
I'm not, but if the board would like to provide further guidance, I would definitely take that into consideration before we move forward on this.
I definitely support overhead, some, a certain percentage of overhead costs being included in these. I think it's absolutely necessary to help support the mechanism that carries out this project. Are there any other comments from the board, Dr. Martin?
So one, I hope, simple question first. Regarding the development of the list of potential projects, is your vision that, so I couldn't tell from the write-up if what Lahontan's role was going to be in that sort of annual update issue. Is it, so is that completely left up to the partners to do that, or is, or does Lahontan kind of envision at least reaching out to them, sort of reminding them that this deadline is approaching?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're trying to tie our update in with the update that the partner organizations already do, which they do.
Okay.
A lot of them update, I believe, every 2 years as part of the whole IREM process.
Okay.
So the MOU will have a date to provide us with a list, and of course we would provide outreach to get that, to say, hey, remember, we need this. And once we get that list, we'll evaluate it to make sure that it complies with the criteria that the board established in the program, and then we'll post those eligible projects on our website.
Okay. So is that going to be part of your annual work plan to do that?
Okay. Yeah,
that's great. Now, okay, here's an out-of-the-box idea. Sorry. this question of building institutional capacity throughout our region, I mean, this is a stumbling block we come up against over and over and over again. I'm not sure how much that can be addressed through government funds and those sorts of things that are available. There are foundations, private foundations, that do support developing institutional capacity. The Roseburg Foundation, I believe, is one up in Oregon that has supported developing institutional capacity in California. There may be others, and so I'm curious, can we form some sort of, I mean, I hate to say, Truckee River Watershed Council, go out and spread the good word, you know, but, say, add to your workload. So there's, I'm just wondering if we can form some sort of partnership for trying to raise money for doing that institutional capacity building throughout our region. I don't know. Who has thoughts on that? I want to hear.
I think we certainly can partner with our other agencies in other areas to see if we can find possibilities for that. Sometimes universities have those pots of money. I found, I mean, you'd be surprised. There's different places. There's the private foundations. I mean, there's some unique places where there might be funds. I see it less often in government funds because they tend to pay for bricks and mortar kind of things more so. But I know the Center for Collaborative Study does anything, and that's a CSU program. We were talking about that for Hinkley, even, to help them with the Hinkley 2.0. So, but I do think we could try to, you know, start, you know, shaking the bushes and see what we can find in terms of these. Because I do know that, particularly for Eamon and Pelop or even Mojave, they're going to need some help with that kind of capacity. That, I mean, it's going to be really tough for them to develop.
I wonder if we could maybe also think about working with the Sierra Water Work Group, because that group works with all the Irwins. And they're in a, assuming there's 18 applicable Irwins, there are 18 levels of progression. and that might be helpful. I can ask some people at CCCP, because I'm working with them anyway, with Owens Lake. So, but the water work group, at least, if you can get all these people kind of herded together, that would be helpful. I don't want to impose too much, which means I want to impose some on the Truckee River Council people. But, I mean, you know, they've just done such a wonderful job, and in any way that we can encourage other people to painlessly try to share with them that information, I think would be really helpful to people.
The only other thought I have is that, so I'm not clear from your presentation whether this is going to keep coming back in front of the board every time you have a potential agreement with another partner, or whether, I mean, whether it might be good to have an annual update from you about how this program is developing.
Yeah, I did that on purpose.
Love that thing.
The resolution is actually kind of silent on who approves the MOU. I think it does allow our executive officer to approve and sign off on an MOU, and I've had these discussions with Patty on, is this something that we should be bringing to the board, or is this something that, you know, how are we going to proceed with this? So I would like some feedback on that. Is this something you would like?
I know staff were open to anything the board wants. We've had our strides. It's hard to judge when you haven't been done yet what it looks like, you know, to bring that to a board. But it could work either way, where along the way we give updates. We're working on MOU. It looks like this. Would you like to come back to the board?
Well, I think after you meet with these groups, I'd like to get an update, as well as what you've found in the way of percentage for administrative or overhead allocation. I'm more familiar with a 10 to 12% administrative allocation, so maybe you can look at some different grant funding mechanisms and come back to us with a percentage, because I think it's important that we be well thought out in how we approve these monies moving ahead. You know, so we're not getting 20% for administrative overhead when other agencies have a much lesser.
The SEP policy does not allow for overhead costs, so I don't know how we could fit that in. You know, there may be some way that, I don't know, we work the money, but I think it's Section H, says that oversight costs are not costs that should be considered part of the direct cost of the SEP. So we'll have to kind of think about how to work that.
Right. I think that was geared more towards a discharger overseeing a project as opposed to hiring a third party to do it. But we need to work around that.
Yeah, no, we should look at that and see what possibilities there might be in creating a fund or how that might work.
Yeah.
I mean, this might be a good discussion with Chris Perrin and his council on this, because I know Region 5 has done something with this foundation, the EJ money. They must have given you something for overhead, because in the house they've done it, so...
Yeah, organizations aren't doing this for free.
Yeah. That's a good dialogue with our friend Chris Kerrigan about the policy and what's practical.
So bring that back as part of the conversation after you've met with these.
Yeah, I like that suggestion. I mean, maybe so it's, let's take the next step, report back to us after you've met with these organizations, and then we'll see whether this becomes like an annual update item or something that we need more frequent interaction on. That'd be fine.
Any other discussion? Okay, thank you for that.